Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror. We're podcasting from the horrid and kind of rainy halls in Toronto. And I'm here, this is Alex, with my co-host, who is fine, apparently. She's fine. She's here. So that's really good.
Of course I'm here. Where else would I be?
I don't know. I just hadn't really talked to you for a couple weeks after our last episode, but I'm so glad I don't have to look for a new editor for this podcast. In this episode, we're going to talk about Jonathan Demme's 1991 film, The Silence of the Lambs.
You spook easily, Starling?
Not yet, sir.
He's past the others. The last cell. I'll be watching. You'll do fine.
A killer is on the loose.
Keeps them alive for 3 days. Then he shoots them, skins them, and dumps them.
A rookie FBI agent is on his trail.
He's got real physical strength, cautious, precise, and he's never impulsive. He'll never stop.
But in order to track him down, she'll have to match wits.
I'll help you catch him, Clary.
Believe me, you don't want Hannibal Lecter inside your head.
With the darkest of all minds.
Just do your job and never forget what he is.
But he's a monster. Pure psychopath. So rare to capture one alive.
So close to the way you're gonna catch him, do you realize that?
Oh, Clarice, your problem is you need to get more fun out of life.
You told me you don't spook easily.
You call this easy, sir?
Lecter's missing an arm.
Man's a raving maniac. Who knows what he'll do?
We came to this topic when we were talking one day about the success of the new NBC show Hannibal, which is produced by Bryan Singer, who did Usual Suspects and the X-Men first couple movies. And so now they have Hannibal on NBC, and this has been a really interesting television show to follow as a horror fan. I personally find the show kind of goofy. There's a lot of CGI stags. The acting is all over the place. I mean, Hugh Dancy's not only wrestling with doing an American accent, but also wrestling with playing autistic, which is frankly kind of embarrassing a lot of the time. But it's portraying really graphic violence in a really interesting way on network television. And it really has drawn in a lot of fans. I think I'm in the minority when I say I did not like it. But, so we started talking about the origin, the first kind of on-screen incarnation of Hannibal Lecter. And as we started talking about it, both Andrew and I had these kind of different memories of it, but we kept talking about it because it was such a rich and interesting topic to discuss and to, frankly, sink our teeth into.
Yes, true enough. So we've gotten together and we've got ourselves a nice bottle of Chianti. We have... can get our hands on any liver or lima bean, so we've got buffalo wings to represent Buffalo Bill. Buffalo wing chips, actually. Maybe not the best choice for podcasting. Can you hear that? That's not loud, is it?
No, you're graceful.
Okay, good.
That's how I imagine a swan eats a chip.
So we are going to talk about Silence of the Lambs, and if you haven't seen it, I don't know where you've been this past, 20 years?
Yeah.
We are going to talk about the movie. We're going to talk about the beginning and the middle and the end. But as Alex and I were just kind of saying when we were chatting before we started recording, this movie is so complex and the mysteries and twistings and turnings are so good and so novel. I feel like we couldn't give anything away by talking about it. It's not really a spoiler, but nonetheless, you'll appreciate it more if you go have a watch and thank us later because it's excellent.
Silence of the Lambs is the story of Clarice Starling, played by Jodie Foster. She's a young FBI trainee agent. She gets called in one day by Jack Crawford, the head of the behavioral science unit of the FBI. Her new assignment now, before she graduates, is to interview Dr. Hannibal Lecter, or Hannibal the Cannibal, as he is also known. He was a once really prestigious psychiatrist who wound up eating some people And other people didn't like that so much, so they put him in jail. And they've thrown away the key, essentially, and placed him under the surveillance of one Dr. Chilton, who's a very egomaniacal, kind of awful fellow in and of himself. So Clarice goes under the guise of just gaining some knowledge and possibly to fill out his kind of behavioral profile. But what the real motivation to talk to Lecter is, and what Clarice eventually realizes, is to gain information about the Buffalo Bill case. Now, Buffalo Bill is a serial killer who is at large, and what he does is he kidnaps women, starves them, kills them, and then skins them. As the movie starts, a little while into it, Buffalo Bill eventually captures Catherine, who is the daughter of a senator. So now higher offices of American politics are really coming down on the FBI to apprehend this killer and save Catherine. So it's a race against time. Clarice and Dr. Lecter are both kind of playing games with each other and trying to help each other in different ways. And it's a really complicated and subtle and very interesting relationship. At the same time, you also have Clarice fighting for respect and to gain confidence enough to trust her instincts and eventually apprehend Buffalo Bill.
Oh, sorry. Are you done talking?
No, it's fine. It's fine. Just stop chewing on my arm.
So for myself, I hadn't seen the movie in several years. I saw it when it first came out. I loved it. I loved it for its puzzles and its characters and its complexity. But I have to say that upon the rewatch, I really overlooked and underestimated the character of Clarice. And so watching it this time, I thought she was such an incredible example of a feminist character. And I am so often asked what a good feminist character in horror looks like. And so often I'm at a loss of a really good example. Her gender role simultaneously helps her and hinders her in this role. You know, it helps her in that the way that she does profiling, she notices things that a woman would notice. Like when she's looking at the victim, she notices an extra piercing on her ear and glitter nail polish. Oh, she's not a local, which is a really important piece of information that Crawford might not have picked up.
What else do you see, Sterling?
Well, she's not local. Her ears are pierced three times, and there's a glitter nail polish. It looks like town to me.
But it also kind of hinders her because Crawford does display some institutional sexism, but the way she handles it is so beautiful. She handles it with this quiet dignity, and then later when she's alone with him, she's like, you know what, that's not okay, because the other police officers saw that and they learned from that, which was a really sophisticated understanding of the reproduction of institutional sexism. And I was blown away that that just slipped past me the first time I saw it.
Sterling, when I told that sheriff we shouldn't talk in front of a woman, that really burned you, didn't it? It was just smoke, Starling. I had to get rid of him.
Matters, Mr. Crawford. Cops look at you to see how to act. Matters.
Point taken.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing, and I'll post this to our Facebook and Twitter. There's a History Channel documentary about the real-life Silence of the Lambs, and it's a 44-minute documentary. And actually, when the Behavioral Procedures Department started in the FBI, they did actually go to all these kind of serial killers they had in custody and started interviewing them. What they realized was the serial killers very rarely responded well to male FBI agents, but they actually responded far more to female FBI agents. So there was a lot of work internally within the FBI to get women trained in this kind of regard and get them in to interview these serial killers, because it did actually have a huge impact in these cases. And then alternatively, after Silence of the Lambs was released and was a huge success, the FBI saw a huge enrollment boom in female FBI cadets, which is pretty amazing. The other thing I was thinking, because I very much agree with Andrea about this, was this film came out in 1991. And there was a real sense, if you go back and watch, there's a great two-disc special edition DVD, if you can watch that, about how progressive this film was and how progressive they tried to be with this film, which I really do think they succeeded at. And that, you know, thinking back to then, I mean, I was still a kid, but you would think a character like this would have really blown open the doors for a lot more strong female characters who were not in romantic relationships, who were not defined by any one thing, but had their own kind of internal life. Now, That being said, there was kind of a whole genre of film of this kind of really hyper-violent thriller procedural drama that was produced from Silence of the Lambs. So you have things like Kiss the Girls, Along Came a Spider, Seven, Copycat. Frankly, almost any movie Morgan Freeman did in the 90s was probably some kind of take on Silence of the Lambs.
For the first time ever, you and I are in total agreement.
I almost find it strange that in all my reading on feminist characters, I reference Ripley from Aliens in every single book and very rarely Clarice Starling. And I almost feel like it's because it's so well done that it just really flies under the radar. Such a real character who is not flashy. She's not overtly feminine or overtly masculine. She just kind of got in under the radar.
And I think Ted Talley, the screenwriter, and Jonathan Demme, the director, do such an amazing job at really subtly putting the audience in her shoes, in her cheap, sensible shoes, that they do such a good job at that. I think that's why you have this, you know, really engaging, well-made film full of great performances that is kind of very subtly leaning you towards a female gaze, because it's not going to make a big deal out of it. It's a very humanistic story. It's a story about people. And one of the interviews I was watching with Jonathan Demme, when he had a meeting with Jodie Foster about possibly doing this movie and her starring, Jodie Foster said to him, "This is about a woman, a young woman, trying to save another young woman. That's what this movie is about." And it's so simple, and yet it's so complicated and wonderful.
That's interesting, because I actually hadn't considered the victim was a woman. I mean, it's true, but I feel like her ambition is mostly just to succeed with her career, right? She has this vulnerability, but it's linked to her inexperience and not her gender. Now, shortly after watching the movie and really loving it, I read the novel and I enjoyed it very much. I thought it was a very faithful adaptation of the novel, and I believe the screenwriter won an Oscar for the best adapted screenplay, didn't he?
Silence of the Lambs is actually a really interesting case, because it won, it's one of the few films to ever win all five major categories at the Oscars. So Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress, Best Actor, and Best Screenplay.
After reading that, a neighbor of mine was telling me, "Well, you read Silence of the Lambs and you liked it. You've got to read Red Dragon, because that book scared the living shit out of this man." So he lent it to me and I checked it out. And then I watched Manhunter, the original movie, which is pretty all right.
Yeah,
I thought it was pretty underrated. I mean, obviously it didn't have the same elements of Silence of the Lambs that we're going to get into that made it so popular and so successful, but particularly if you set it in contrast with the 2002 remake of the movie called Red Dragon, it can't compare. But you've got a different monster. This one's called the Tooth Fairy, aka Frances Dolarhyde, who is a really sympathetic and tragic monster. And it's a kind of complexity that you don't really feel for our villain in Silence of the Lambs, Jamie Gumm. Crawford makes an appearance, Chilton is still there, but the lead protagonist is male. And I put it to you, the listener, if you have any suggestions on whether Silence of the Lambs is superior because it had a female protagonist. Did it work better? What do you think?
Well, and I will say this, because Andrea actually hasn't watched any of Hannibal, but Will Graham, he's the protagonist in Hannibal, the TV series.
Yeah.
And he's autistic. Have I mentioned that? Because it's super awkward to watch him do that.
Please don't psychoanalyze me. You won't like me when I'm psychoanalyzed.
Will.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go give a lecture on psychoanalyzing.
And I have to say, that being said, the Red Dragon film, obviously with Anthony Hopkins and Ralph Fiennes and Edward Norton as Will Graham, is one of my favorite movies to watch hungover. It's so goofy and bizarre and silly. I really get a kick out of watching it.
You say that about Fatal Attraction?
Yes, one of them. So it's probably Red Dragon, Fatal Attraction, and Basic Instinct.
Interesting. We're going to have to pick out consistent threads through all three movies and see what aspects of these movies appeal to Alex in a dehydrated, alcohol-poisoned state.
It's probably just Edward Norton with his shirt off.
So another great thing about Silence of the Lambs is we get not one, but two monsters. We get two fantastic villains, and they're both terrifying. I think Alex and I would agree that Lecter steals the show. But Jamie Gumm, in his own, is a really crazy, creepy character. Now, the book gives a little bit more background to his problem. His name was supposed to be James Gumm, and due to a misspelling on his birth certificate, the S got forgotten. And so it's just J-A-M-E, which some people pronounce James, some people pronounce Jamie. People didn't really know what to call him. So this was kind of the birth of his tremendous identity crisis and need for a transformation later on. And I thought it was so interesting when Hannibal says he thinks he's homosexual, but he's not. I feel that was a really interesting remark, because here we are in the 80s, 90s, when coming out seemed to explain everything, right? Every bizarre behavior that couldn't be explained was easily explained away. Why, oh, he was closeted, oh, he was this, he was that. You're depressed, you're probably gay. You're weird, you're probably gay. You have a compulsion to wear a women's skin suit? Well, that might not quite cover it.
Billy is not a real transsexual, but he thinks he is. He tries to be. He's tried to be a lot of things, I expect.
And I think it's an interesting fact to bring up, because not only through the late 80s and early 90s was there the panic surrounding the AIDS crisis, which was obviously very prevalent, but Silence of the Lambs was condemned for being an anti-gay movie. It was protested at different cinemas. It was protested, I believe, at the Oscars. Jonathan Demme, to his credit, really kind of came out and said this was not meant as anti-homosexual. This is not homophobic. James Gumm is not a gay character. He is a confused person. He is a psychotic. He is not gay. And I think that message may have gotten lost in the film. It is clearly said, but I can understand his reading. And I have to say, to Jonathan Demme's credit, in my mind anyway, his next film was actually Philadelphia.
Mr. Beckett!
How are you? What happened to your face?
I have AIDS.
So I think it's quite an interesting thing, and it's a very complicated matter, but I think that speaks to how layered and perverse James Gumm as a character is. And it's quite terrifying, because as Lecter so rightfully points out, we can't just place a label on him. You know, people are just genuinely scared of him. People draw away from him in his own life. And this need to transform, you know, it's deeply unsettling. And every time he's on screen, I feel really uncomfortable, because he's so in your face with it. And there's the obviously very amazing and very iconic scene, kind of dancing and putting on a show for himself. And he sets up the video camera. And then our point of view as the audience becomes the video camera. And what we see through that is, you know, we are one on one. We are face to face with this man who is kind of awkward and goofy on one level, you know, trying to put on this little performance for himself. But it's so disturbing and uncomfortable to watch. I feel bad for the dog. So one thing that we're going to kind of start talking about through all these characters as we deal with them is this notion of fairy tales. And I think Silence of the Lambs does a really great job at inversing and supporting a kind of fairy tale dynamic. So James Gumm in this is very clearly, I think, the kind of evil witch. He's the kind of ultimate big bad, since we just watched a bunch of Buffy. But he's the kind of ultimate antagonist in this film, even though, as Andrea said, we do have two monsters who come into play at different times. James Gunn is the ultimate antagonist and the person that Clarice, our hero, our final hero, must face down in order to achieve her goal.
Right. And in this light, we can kind of look at Hannibal as kind of this archetypal trickster character who is kind of a danger, kind of a help. You know, he's a danger to kind of everyone but our heroine, because he seems to want to help her, but he's playful and he's not quite clear with his motives.
And you can never fully hate him. And I think it's important to remember that from the 1960s, you know, all the way up until the 90s, I think up and through till the 90s, America and our popular culture had a real obsession with serial killers, starting with Ed Gein and obviously Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. There is this really kind of pervasive, insidious, underlining news thread throughout the media. So then you have people like, obviously, the Zodiac Killer, Ted Bundy, Charles Manson, insane people doing horrific things to random people and the media just kind of constantly reporting on it. So what Thomas Harris did was actually kind of combine and analyze several of these characters to build them into Hannibal Lecter and into James Gum. But it really does kind of come out of this bizarre underlining psychosis in American media, the kind of notion of you don't ever truly know your neighbor, because these are all normal, seemingly decent men who just went crazy. And you don't know what could possibly happen to you. So it's not a kind of grand gothic horror. Horror is kind of coming home to rest.
I live in the American Gardens building on West 81st Street, on the 11th floor. My name is Patrick Bateman. I'm 27 years old. I believe in taking care of myself, in a balanced diet, and a rigorous exercise routine. In the morning, if my face is a little puffy, I'll put on an ice pack while doing my stomach crunches. I can do 1,000 now.
So while James Gum is a reprehensible monster, Hannibal, on the other hand, Dr. Lecter, to others, is a much more enjoyable character. There is something I think an audience just inherently likes about him. And that's not only Anthony Hopkins' performance, which was his breakout role and what led him onto his career that he has now and his several houses in Malibu, I'm sure, but it's this kind of respect that Dr. Lecter has for people, this kind of empathetic notion of humanity, where if someone treats him badly, he'll go after them and he'll punish them. But if you're kind and respectful to him, he will generally try to do some kind of, it might be through mind games, but he will try to help you.
Upon the rewatch, Lecter, I read Lecter differently, just like I read Clarice differently. I found Hannibal Lecter to be so, so scary. Whereas the first time, you know, the image of Anthony Hopkins in that mask with his eyes kind of glaring has become an iconic image of Hollywood horror and madness. But the image to me was always kind of funny because it's an image of him in his restraints. You know, granted, he did get away and it was a tremendous getaway. But for the most part, he was locked in that little cell for a long time and as neutered as a predator could possibly be, particularly when he's got that mask on. So I always thought that image was kind of, oh yeah, Hannibal Lecter, like you don't want him to talk you to death, oh god. And then when I was watching it, I felt a real empathy with Clarice of how terrifying it is to give someone very little information and have them just read you like a book and drop these huge truths about you. And it's very invasive, and it makes you feel very, very vulnerable, which Clarice is already feeling both as a trainee and as a woman.
Oh, agents, darling, you think you can dissect me with this blunt little tool?
No, I thought that your knowledge...
You're so ambitious, aren't you? Do you know what you look like to me with your good bag and your cheap shoes? You look like a rube, a well-scrubbed hustling rube. A little taste. Good nutrition's given you some length of bone, but you're not more than one generation from poor wire trash, are you, Agent Starling? And that accent you've tried so desperately to shed, pure West Virginia. What is your father dear? Is he a coal miner? Does he stink of the land? And oh, how quickly the boys found you. All those tedious, sticky fumblings in the back seats of cars, while you could only dream of getting out, getting anywhere. Getting all the way to the end.
So I found him a wonderful character. He was brilliant. He was capable of such psychological manipulation, but also physical brutality when he needs to.
I think the interesting turning point in the film, and what I would kind of call the point that actually gets the story moving forward in a really serious way, is after Clarice has gone to see Hannibal for the first time. And it hasn't gone very well because he's kind of seen through the game and he's doesn't like that Jack Crawford has sent a trainee to go talk to him. So he sends her on her way and embarrasses her and humiliates her and makes her feel pretty goddamn bad about herself. And then as she's walking away, the other inmates start going crazy in this kind of locked away hall. And the inmate next to Hannibal Lecter named Miggs has been pleasuring himself and throws his ejaculate at Clarice. It hits her in the face, and the look on her face is just pure embarrassment, and you can just read her as just being so ashamed and humiliated through the core. And it's just such an incredible brief moment. At that point, Hannibal yells at her and calls her back to his cell and gives her just enough clues to get her started on this case.
I would not have had that happen to you. Discourtesy is unspeakably ugly to me.
Then do this test for me.
No, but I will make you happy. I'll give you a chance for what you love most.
And what is that, Doc?
Advancement, of course. Listen carefully. Look deep within yourself, Clarice, darling. Go seek out Miss Moffat, an old patient of mine. M-O-F-E-T. Go
Doctor.
Now. I don't think Mix could manage again quite so soon, even though he is crazy. Go now!
So if Miggs hadn't have done that, I'm not sure the story would have progressed in the way that it did, but it was Hannibal's understanding of humanity that allowed him to move forward and allowed him to kind of see something else in Clarice where he wanted to help. He understood her in a new way and he wanted to help.
Right. I mean, insofar as Lecter also humiliated her, he humiliated her in a condescending, psychological manner, but they met each other as equals in the beginning. They had a little bit of, they stroked each other's ego and there was a bit of banter before he kind of got the upper hand. But Miggs also humiliated her, but in a sexual manner. And I think for Lecter, that was just too much. That was the low card that he would never, ever play. And it just was too much for him. And so he avenged her for it.
And I think just as you were saying that Clarice and Lecter have that understanding at the very beginning, since Clarice has now been kind of brought down to his level and been embarrassed the way Lecter is by being behind a plate glass wall, he's able to humanize her and actually relate to her more.
So another reason I find Hannibal Lecter to be one of the most fascinating horror movie monsters of all time is I have a bit of a fascination with the figure of the cannibal. Now, in my book on zombie folklore, I talk about how modern-day zombies are constructed out of some racist and imperialist conceptions, one of them being the distinguishing features between civilization and savagery. And to put it in a nutshell, basically, when white people get scared of black people, they call them savages, and they accuse them of being violent and cannibalistic. And cannibalistic because it's the most savage, inhuman, animalistic thing anyone can do. And they ascribed these traits to zombies because they came from Haiti, where black people also come from. So Hannibal Lecter is the perfect representation of this dichotomy. You know, he perfectly represents the boundary between civilized and savage. He can flick it on and off like a switch. And he's, you know, erudite, he's well-spoken, but he's also a cannibal. And so I thought that was a really interesting feature to give him, apart from his obvious homicidal monstrosity.
Yeah, as much as Silence of the Lambs is a really kind of contemporary horror film, there is something about Dr. Lecter that kind of speaks to that kind of almost Hammer horror, Vincent Price, Christopher Lee, austere British, you know, monster, which I think is really interesting, again, contrasted with James Gunn, who is that kind of slow-talking, weird guy who just looks weird and you'd probably maybe avoid him. Or you try to, at least, unless he asks for help putting a couch into a van.
Can I help you with that?
Would you?
Sure.
Thank you.
That's all right. You look kind of handicapped.
Yeah. I got it this far. I just can't get it up in the trunk. So, yeah, it's good.
Okay.
Good. Just set it down. That's good. Get in the truck, and I want to push it all the way up. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah, all the way there.
Okay. Is this good?
Yeah, that's good.
That's great. Okay.
Hey, are you about a size 14?
Sorry.
So while we've identified the two main antagonists of the piece, there is another character involved in this whole story that the audience doesn't like a whole lot, and that would be Chilton. Dr. Chilton, who we are introduced to through Clarice, then through what Dr. Lecter says about him. He's this kind of power-hungry, middle management cell jail keeper. He doesn't have a lot of power, but the power he does have, he likes to flaunt it. We initially meet him through Clarice when he overtly hits on her, and it's very uncomfortable, and Clarice tries to deflect it. And once she deflects it, Chilton starts treating her quite differently.
You know, we get a lot of detectives here, but I must say I can't ever remember one as attractive. Will you be in Baltimore overnight? Because this can be quite a fun town if you have the right guide.
Well, I'm sure this is a great town, Dr. Chilton, but my instructions are to talk to Dr. Lecter and report back this afternoon.
I see. Well, let's make this quick, then.
So not only do we have that allegiance with Clarice, where we now already don't like him, but then he starts just being mean to Lecter in a very bizarre, fetishistic kind of way. I think that Chilton is kind of our third monster that kind of exists on the periphery to antagonize different characters and push them in different ways. And then on the other side of the coin, another kind of slightly higher up member of this cast of characters is Jack Crawford, the head of the division of FBI that Clarice is working for. And he is slightly older man, but not that old. He's very kind. He kind of plays a dual role of father figure and potential romance for Clarice, but that part is really underdeveloped, which I am thankful for. But there is a nice ambiguity to their relationship.
Look, I just wanted to say congratulations. And I'm not much good at this kind of thing, so I'm going to duck out of here.
Okay, sure. Thank you, Mr. Crawford.
Your father would have been proud today. Don't forget your phone call.
Yes, I also liked that there was a sexual tension that was implied through observation of other people, but nothing actually transpired between them, which is so relatable to me, because when you're working with men, it's like, oh, is something going on between you two? It's like, oh, of course, because he's a man and I'm a woman, right? Why wouldn't there be? So I kind of respected him in that his paternal feelings toward Clarice made him want to protect her from some of the grislier aspects of the crime. But when she calls him out on it, he takes it really well. As for Chilton, I thought what was interesting about Chilton was he seemed to be jealous of both Clarice and Lecter because they both illustrated his inadequacies. I mean, it was Clarice because she was able to get information out of Lecter that Chilton never could, which makes him failed as a doctor, which is why he was jealous of Lecter, because once again, he's clearly the more brilliant behavioral psychologist. And so Chilton's ineptitude combined with his ego make him a really antagonistic and important piece of the puzzle.
What you're doing, Miss Starling, is coming into my hospital to conduct an interview and refusing to share information with me for the third time.
Sir, I told you this is just a routine follow-up on the Raspbell
case. He is my patient. I have rights.
I understand that, sir.
Look, I am not just some turnkey, Miss Starling.
This is the number for the U.S. Attorney's Office. Please, either you discuss this with him or you let me do my job. You understand?
And I think that now we've kind of brought all these characters into play. It is a bit like a chess match. And what's interesting is we've already obviously mentioned Alfred Hitchcock via Psycho, but obviously for any film fans out there, you know of Hitchcock's bomb theory. So that is the idea of you show the audience a ticking bomb that's going to go off at 1 o'clock, let's say, and you show two people talking about something totally innocuous and the time is 12:45. So the audience knows they have 15 minutes until the bomb explodes. So that creates suspense. It creates tension. It's a fantastic thing to use. And what Silence of the Lambs does so brilliantly is it sets up several different bombs through its plot. So obviously the first is Lecter, who is just described as one of the most terrifying figures ever to have existed. He's behind plate glass. He's locked behind 37 doors. He's basically been put away for a very good reason. Now Clarice has to interact with him. The next one is James Gum, who we've already talked about as well. He is a psycho killer. He is on the loose. And who knows what he's going to do next and how they will ever capture him. And then our final big one, is I would argue Dr. Chilton, because he antagonizes the antagonists. There is something so hatefully malevolent about him. There's a sense that you get that Hannibal Lecter and Buffalo Bill kind of suffer from deep-rooted psychoses or their own kind of deep psychological problems, whereas Chilton's just a fucking asshole.
Well, it's almost like he's demented too, but in a more socially acceptable manner. You can be an egomaniac all you want, just don't eat anyone.
And I think one of the first instances we have, as I've already mentioned, of really detesting Chilton is as we get the gaze through Jodie Foster's eyes of Chilton kind of, you know, implying that she should go on a date with him. And it's so insidious and such an abuse of power. And the fact that Clarice handles it with such grace and directness is a real kudos to her. So already we're in her shoes and we already kind of like her way more.
And I feel like that come on actually even started with an implication that she got the assignment based on her looks. The fact that she was able to swallow that and still kind of play ball was so commendable.
Crawford's very clever, isn't he, using you?
What do you mean, sir?
Pretty young woman to turn him on. I don't believe Lecter's even seen a woman in 8 years. And oh, are you ever his taste, so to speak.
And the next instance we have of a man making a pass, let's say, at Clarice, is when she brings the moth that was stuck behind the victim's soft palate to the two, let's say, bug doctors. And while one is examining the encased moth, the other one directly asks her out.
What do you do when you're not detecting, Agent Starling?
Try to be a student, Dr. Pilcher.
You ever go out for cheeseburgers and beer? The amusing house wine?
Are you hitting on me, Doctor?
Yes.
It's so awkward and uncomfortable, and I think this goes for men and women. If you've ever been asked out in an uncomfortable situation, it's such a bizarrely human moment to have in the midst of this incredibly epic crime investigation. And that adds yet another layer to the film, but it also adds that sense of, you know, this would never happen to a man. This would never be an issue with a man. But because you're a woman and you're coming into this situation, you were obviously available for this.
Another thing I love about this movie is about how peace and harmony is restored in the end. And it almost seems wrong that, spoiler alert, Hannibal Lecter is out and on the loose. And Clarice should be terrified, but she's not. She says, I know he's not going to come after me. And she knows he's not a threat to her, but he is a threat to Chilton. And it's a threat that we kind of really want to see realized. It's ironic to me that this transformation that Jamie Gumm was so obsessed with, and his obsession with these moths and their transformation phases, the transformation into maturity that he had hoped to induce on himself actually happened to Clarice instead. So it has a very satisfying, harmonious ending where you see her make it to make an officer. Crawford's proud of her. Chilton's probably fucked, and Hannibal's gonna, we're gonna stay up at night and think about him.
And I think it's an interesting point, not only Clarice's transformation, but on a more primarily physical level, Lecter's transformation in order to escape. Not only does he brutalize and kill two officers, he has the time, in a very short span of time, to take off one of their skins, slow his heart rate, have a seizure, and get out of there. That is one of the best Houdini-like transformation magic tricks ever. And that is the reason why Jamie Gunn got caught and why Lecter didn't.
Starling.
Well, Clarice. Have the lamb stopped screaming?
Lecter, Lecter.
Don't bother with the trace. I won't be on long enough.
Where are you, Dr. Lecter?
I have no plans to call on you, Clarice. The world's more interesting with you in it. So you take care now to extend me the same courtesy.
You know I can't make that promise.
I do wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner. Bye.
Dr. Lecter. Dr. Lecter. Dr. Lecter.
So one of the final characters we want to talk about in this episode is Catherine, the senator's daughter who is kidnapped by Buffalo Bill. As we meet her, she is just driving along, minding her own business. And then as Buffalo Bill fakes a hand injury or an arm injury, very similar to Ted Bundy, he gets her into a van, hits her, and knocks her out. He's going to keep her in a well for a few days, starve her, get her skin nice and loose so he can shoot her, and then carve off some of her skin. What I think is really interesting about Catherine is it's such an emotional performance. I think the actress did a really great job. But I love where the story takes her, where she refuses to be a victim by her being as inventive as she could with the implement she had, by getting that bone on a string and getting Precious somehow down into that well. That scene we're never shown, but it is interesting. That dog winds up in that well with her, and she's now holding that dog hostage. So Buffalo Bill now kind of, for a brief, very brief scene, has to answer to her. And it's a very interesting power struggle, not only from the way it's set. She's down a well, he's up above her, and that whole power dynamic is so interesting and complicated, and it's beautifully shot as well. I mean, I think there's very few lines as iconic as "it puts the lotion on its skin."
It rubs the lotion on its skin. It does this whenever it's told.
Mister, my family will pay cash. Whatever ransom you're asking for, they'll pay it.
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
I also noticed for the first time on the rewatch, I don't know if you caught this, and it's not very analytically significant, but did you notice that when Catherine's coming out after the police are there, that she's still clutching Precious? Best friends for life now, having survived that psychopath.
I feel like she probably dresses up that dog still. I would.
In a skin suit?
In a skin suit. Caught it first. Yeah, I like that they gave that character weight. And I mean, going back to the fairy tale theory I'd brought up, Catherine is the princess locked in the castle. So Clarice, who is the knight in shining armor, must go in and find her. And she must battle her way through all these obstacles, whether they are institutional sexism to a serial killer. Clarice Starling takes it all on. And that's why she's a badass. And Catherine, for having nothing down in that well and attempting to fight back, is another kind of hero. And it is so, again, this is a really humanistic movie because you see all these characters, whether they are right or wrong, fighting for what they believe in. And all of their goals conflict with each other and, you know, in a lot of different senses. So it's a very interesting thing. And I love, as we get into the final scene, it's a very interesting moment when Jodie Foster kind of comes into Buffalo Bill's lair and she's saying to Catherine, "You're safe. Everyone else is going to come." Clarice doesn't know that. She's just trying to make this girl feel better. And she's telling her to shut up and keep the dog quiet.
"You're all right, Catherine. Now, where is he?
How the fuck should I know? Just get me out of here.
Catherine, you got to be quiet. Now shut that dog up.
Just get me out of here."
"Catherine, I'm going to get you out of there, but right now, you listen to me. I've got to leave this room. I'll be right back."
"No, don't you leave me here, you fucking bitch. No, don't you leave me here. This guy is fucking crazy."
And, you know, as much as we are happy to, you know, these two characters have found each other, they're now kind of at odds because one of them is just yelling to get out and the other one is telling them to shut the fuck up.
I also thought it was neat how they paid quite a bit of attention to Catherine's mother doing that plea on TV. And I think nowadays it's something kind of we all recognize, these psychological techniques of humanizing hostages and victims. But I think at the time that was the first time you'd see something like that in a movie, and they made it a point for Clarice to observe it.
Well, and I think that's what Silence of the Lambs really does, is it makes, again, as I was saying, a humanist film. It breaks down some of these kind of highfalutin concepts of investigation into just making people appear more human than they actually are. It's about understanding a serial killer. It's about making a victim real to the killer. You know, it's all of those things that really try to bring to the forefront the characters rather than the situation. So one of the main film techniques in Silence of the Lambs is the different viewpoints throughout the film. Obviously, we've talked about Laura Mulvey's theory of the gaze through film, so you can go back and listen to our old episodes if you need to catch up on that. But basically, it's the theory that a lot of cinema engenders a male gaze on female characters. what Silence of the Lambs does is it places us, the entire audience, in Clarice's shoes. So we've talked about this already in the episode. But what you'll see is we have a lot of, this film really lives in its close-up shots. So its close-up shots exist when someone is looking directly at the camera. That is generally someone looking directly at Clarice. Then we have a lot of close-up shots of Clarice, and she's always looking slightly off camera. Like, she's always off to the side just a bit. So we still get her gaze, but it's never quite direct. So that's a sense that we are distancing ourselves because we are not in her shoes. The main point it breaks in this is towards the end. Obviously, there is about a 10 or 15 minute sequence where Hannibal escapes from his confinements and makes a break for it. That's the point where we leave Clarice's viewpoint and becomes a more omniscient viewpoint. The camera takes on that omniscient, godlike view of the proceedings. Now, the other point in time is when, again, towards the end of the film, we transition a bit more into Buffalo Bill's perspective. So as I mentioned before, it is when he's kind of filming himself dancing around to Goodbye Horses, and he's doing himself up, and he's, you know, talking about how he'd fuck himself. You know, so we are seeing him directly on, but it is a camera's gaze. And in one of the final sequences of the film, Clarice gets into the same room as Buffalo Bill. The lights go off. Clarice is in the dark, just trying to protect herself and stay safe and save the day. We then see Buffalo Bill flip into night vision, and we are able to view the proceedings from Buffalo Bill's gaze through night vision.
And Clarice attracts a male gaze in groups several times throughout the film as well. There's in the beginning where she's been jogging and she kind of walks by this group of guys and they all rubberneck her. There's the scene where she's with Crawford and he leaves her alone in that room and they just all stare. You know, it's something that she endures in the elevator scene. The elevator scene?
Oh, when she gets into the elevator towards the beginning of the film and it's all these guys in red shirts and they all kind of like look at her and she's so much shorter than all of them. And I think what's interesting about that final scene in regards to the night vision, it brings back the bomb theory from Hitchcock. So we are no longer in Clarice's shoes, which is a very odd viewpoint for us to be in because we have been so aligned with her the whole film. But now we are in Buffalo Bill's shoes. And it is that sense of he's the only kind of character that's really transgressed that viewpoint. So it's a weird place to be in and watch this character. So we have that notion of we know he's got a gun. We know that he can see her. But we get that final sound of him unlocking the gun and pulling it back for him to shoot her. That turns her around and she lets loose on him. So filmically, it's, I think, a really complicated scene to kind of process, but it's a film that really earns that kind of complication and that kind of discussion and that moment.
And like you said, we've been so closely aligned with her throughout. For us suddenly to be broken away from her kind of harkens back to the ticking time bomb that you were talking about earlier, where the audience knows that there's a danger that the characters in question don't know. So I think that was kind of a device to make that happen. And it sure was terrifying, particularly when he reaches his hand out to almost touch her and we're all just cringing and shivering because she has no idea. It actually reminded me there was several scenes like that in the Maniac remake, like we talked about recently at the Rue Morgue podcast. Was the creepiest scenes is where he's right behind her in the dark and she has no idea. And so insofar as we have the viewpoint of the killer, our hearts and our souls and our concerns are very much with the victim.
And I think it goes into that notion, I believe, that we also talked about in that episode at the Rue Morgue podcast, where it's that sense of dread versus surprise. Silence of the Lambs maybe only has a couple moments of genuine surprise, but the dread that just builds up through this entire film, it's so unsettling. I love that moment where Clarice is first coming to meet Lecter, and he's just standing in the middle of his cell. Like he's waiting for her, like he could smell her. And it's so bizarre and incomprehensible, but like it's not totally out of the norm. So you would never really be able to say anything about it. And I think it's just a fascinating moment of film. And I think you could say that about pretty much all of this movie.
So basically, to wrap it up, if you haven't gotten the gist that this movie rules, then you haven't been paying attention. If you haven't seen it in a while, and I've talked to a couple of people about, I'm going to record a podcast on Silence of the Lambs. Oh, I haven't seen that in a long time. Go back to it. Rewatch it. It holds up beautifully. You wouldn't believe it. And it's because it doesn't rely on anything trendy, any CGI, any nonsense. It's just really well written, perfectly performed, well directed. It's awesome.
And it's a film that works because not only because of all the things Andrea mentioned, which are more than true, but I think because it inverts and subverts our expectations of what a traditional story is going to be like. And we have to remember that this film really broke through a lot of barriers in regards to the horror, thriller, genre, suspense film. You know, to have a female protagonist, to have complicated male characters that surrounded her, this was totally new. And as we've mentioned before, there are so many films that have riffed on those themes, but have never been able to duplicate really the success and the gut-wrenching quality of Silence of the Lambs. There is nothing more humanistic, there is nothing more beautiful and terrifying than this film.
Once again, I'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode, Rocca delle Macchie. That's my stab at it. It's a nice Chianti, and it's a really pretty bottle, getting prettier as I drink, and it did the job really well, even though we didn't have fava beans. And instead of a... you've got this. We'd also like to thank our network at Modern Superior. If you haven't checked out our appearance on the Rue Morgue podcast, you've got to go check that out. It is a humongous episode. We were interviewed by Stuart for hours and hours on end. It was grueling. Alex cried.
I did. It's like the inside the actor studio of podcasting, if you haven't heard it.
And speaking of which, we have been invited to do a panel at the Rue Morgue Festival of Fear at Fan Expo here in Toronto in August. And we're going to be on a panel called Misadventures in Horror Podcasting, whereupon we will sit alongside the likes of horror podcast gods, Stuart Feedback Andrews, Last Chance Lance, Mike White from the Projection Booth, and Mike Felcher from Dead Pit Radio. So we are so excited to be included among the ranks of such hard-hitting names as those, and we're really excited for that.
And if I may plug another little thing going on at the Festival of Fear, that my lovely co-host is also going to be doing another panel, because she's that cool, about the Black Museum, which is the horror lecture series that she co-curates in Toronto that I was lucky enough to be a part of this past semester. And she's going to be doing a condensed repeat of her lecture, Unearthed, The Sociology of Zombies. I saw it fall 2012 here in Toronto. It was amazing. If anyone is in or around the Toronto area or planning to come into town for Fan Expo, make that a date. Put it in your calendar once that calendar is up. Find it. Make sure you check it out, because if you like this podcast, if you're listening to this podcast, you will love that lecture.
So from myself, Andrea Subisati, and my co-host,
Alex West,
we wish you a wonderful and safe summer. Try to stay in your skin and eat your veggies, and we will see you next time.
Office hours are closed.